So the topic I chose for tonight, as I mentioned earlier, is called The Seven Factors of Awakening, the Buddha's Roadmap to Enlightenment. The Seven Factors of Awakening is part of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's one of the Dhammas, the things that we need to contemplate in a sense, but understand, take this particular view when we look at things. The Dhammas have different sort of meanings almost. But they're the end section of the Satipatthana Sutta, which is basically the teachings of the Buddha on mindfulness, the actual practice itself. And it's in what's called the fourth foundation, which is the last of the teachings. Interesting thing about this particular teaching, the seven factors of awakening, is it's one of two of those five or six Dhammas, I forget, I never remember whether it's five or six, that actually are occurring in all different translations. The Satipatthana Sutta has been translated into, you know, Chinese and Japanese and Korean and Tibetan and various other, you know, Southeast Asian languages, as well as, of course, English and French and German and all those things. But the only two of the Dhammas that actually appear in every one of those translations are the five kalesas, the five hindrances, and the seven factors of awakening. And the seven factors of awakening is essentially the antidote to the kalesas. So it's an interesting way to look at this teaching. This is the good news. After getting the bad news of why we're struggling so much from looking at the five kalesas, then we get the good news, like, what? See what happens when things are going good. So this is cheerful news. So I want to start just by reading a little bit of the sutta, just so you get a sense of what it is I'm talking about. And this text I'm going to read is the same for all seven factors. So I'll just read the very first one, and then as I go through the factors, imagine I read it for all seven. So this is the actual Buddha's instructions on how to practice with the seven factors of awakening. If the mindfulness awakening factor is present in him, he knows there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. If the mindfulness awakening factor is not present in him, he knows there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. He knows how the unarisen mindfulness awakening factor can arise, and how the arisen mindfulness awakening factor can be perfected by development. So it's a four-piece instruction for each of the seven factors of awakening. Know it's there. Know it's not there, if it's not there. if it's there, know it's there. If it's not there, know that. Know what causes and conditions can create the possibility of it arising. And if it has arisen, do whatever you can to keep it. Those second two are basically half of the description of right effort Eightfold Path. So this is essentially he's just taking that instruction and moving over to a different place, which is what the Buddha does all the time in his teachings. He just mixes and matches, I think, sometimes. So. But it's I would love to be able to do a Dharma talk where I explained all four of those for all seven awakening factors, but would probably be here till around midnight. So I'm not going to do that. You know, it might also be a great, you know, a seven-part series. You could do it for each of the seven over seven teachings or something. I'll plan that for the distant future. But for now, just at various times, I'll mention one or more of these four things that the Buddha is saying. Know if it's there. Know if it's not there. Know how it arises, and know how it's maintained if it does arise. So, when we sit here, what are we doing? Good question. We are doing, or trying to do, what is called sati. Sati is mindfulness. We're trying to be mindful. And mindfulness is the first of the seven factors of awakening. But I want to make sure we understand that often what we're doing when we're sitting here may not be particularly mindful. Everybody's going, yeah. In fact, what we're doing is we're doing the best we can to create the causes and conditions such that the mind state, the wholesome mind state of mindfulness, will arise. So sitting there, you know, noting the breath and doing all those things we do, those practices, those methods we use, are just skillful means to create the conditions such that mindfulness might arise. Note, I said might. You know, and also might not. But we're still, if there's right effort involved, you get full marks anyway, so don't worry about that. So there are many different techniques. I mean, I'm sure in this room we probably have people doing 5 or 6 different techniques when we all sit down here. You know, some of us are doing very traditional noting, and some of us are doing, you know, maybe they're doing metta instead of Vipassana. They're doing Tibetan forms, and probably a few Zen Buddhists around in this room. You know, so we're doing lots of different forms, but they all lead to that same thing, mindfulness. And what mindfulness is it's bringing the mind to a state of awareness such that it just knows what's happening right now. What's just happening right now, and now, and now, and now. So mindfulness is just the stringing together, in a sense, of moments of awareness of what's actually arising right now. And when I say what's actually arising at the sense doors, you know, which is really all that's going on. And this practice of just being aware of what's arising in the moment creates the conditions such that mindfulness will arise. But how is it that we know? What are we looking for to know that mindfulness is really there? I mean, the instruction is know if mindfulness is present. Well, how do we know? What qualities does mindfulness have? And this is a really interesting list that I discovered, and I'm still trying to fit it all together, but it makes a lot of sense to me. The first of these four qualities that mindfulness has is not forgetting. We're sitting there, we're being very mindful in noting the breath, and then we forget. And the mind goes off and thinks about what we had for dinner or something else, or what we're going to go, you know, one who's going to go to the bar after Sangha tonight. And whatever it is we're thinking something other than what's arising. And we've gone off on some chain of thought that is no longer in the present moment. So to be mindful is to actually be in a state of not forgetting that you're actually practicing. That you chose to sit on that chair or on the floor, and now you don't forget. So the mind doesn't wander from the object. It's solid. One of the metaphors for this that I found, I really like being a construction guy, is it's solid like a post set in the ground. You know, if you really set a post really well, it doesn't move. It's solid like a post. So the practice is like that. It's there. It's solid. That post is going to stay there for a long time. Second of the four qualities is presence, not looking away. This is particularly true when unpleasant things arise. The tendency when unpleasant things arise in the mind or at the sense doors is that, you know, I don't want to look at that, or to distance yourself, to push away from it, either mentally or even physically. You know, there's that sense of, whoa, you know, leaning back, leaning away from it, don't want to go there. That's lack of presence. It's the opposite of mindfulness. Presence is the state where whatever's arising, whether it be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, we stay with it. We're there noting, paying attention to what is arising. Then the third one was remembering. When I first thought, I went, remembering? What the heck does that have to do with mindfulness? It sounds like memory stuff. But Joseph Goldstein has this wonderful little piece in here that I want to read to you. This is one of my main reference books, by the way. So this is from Joseph Goldstein, when he's talking about this factor of remembering. And I got a bunch of different bookmarks in the same book. Here we go. So this is what he's saying about remembering. The third aspect of sati, of mindfulness, is one that we don't often associate with mindfulness, but in fact, it harkens back to the root meaning of remembering. Here, mindfulness calls to mind or remembers what is skillful and what is not, what is inferior and what is refined, what is beneficial and what is harmful. It is this aspect of mindfulness that makes it possible to follow the Buddha's instruction to let go and abandon what is unskillful and develop and cultivate what is skillful. So there we are sitting and something naughty comes into our mind and we go, naughty however you want to define it. It could be a giant bowl of ice cream or whatever. Something that is a distraction that we know would be unskillful. Part of mindfulness is remembering that and not getting caught in that long chain of fantasy about how are you going to achieve whatever it is you're thinking about. Not being caught in the ideas and story of how to achieve something or do something that is unskillful or unwholesome. How do we know? Because we sit and listen to Dharma talks and we study. That's the purpose of study. Study builds the ground for mindfulness. Without study, without understanding of the teachings, it's pretty hard to know what's skillful and what's unskillful. I mean, we have some sort of, often have a pretty clear idea. You know, well, I'm sitting there fantasizing about robbing a bank. That's probably going to be pretty unskillful, right? But some things are much more subtle than that. And by studying the Dhamma, studying the teachings, you know, the precepts, those sorts of the teachings, we have this sort of mental background basis so that when things arise, we can sort of go, oh, yeah, that's that thing. You know, I know that's unskillful. I don't have to go there. It's why study is so important in this practice, because it helps us see that sense of what's skillful and unskillful as they arise in the mind, and for us to steer away from the unskillful towards the skillful. We're trying to shift the pattern of mind. And the fourth of these things is an association with wisdom, which boils down to simplicity. Keeping things simple. You know, we often, something arises, and instead of just noting what's arisen, out of that arising, we create an incredible story about that arising that goes on and on and on and on and on. And, you know, if we're not careful, it becomes something we not only tell ourselves a story, we start to believe it's true. And then we might even get up off the chair and act on that story. Then we really get into trouble. I have to tell you a funny story about exactly that thing happening. This happened to me at Spirit Rock, which is one of the places I go to sit. And some of you I know have sat there as well. Just outside the main meditation hall, they have this nice pool with a Buddha statue sitting on a pillar in the middle of the pool. And the day, you know, he gets the sun on it and all these interesting reflections. It's quite a beautiful thing. And it's just as you're sort of walking into the meditation hall. But one of the Dharma talks had been, recent Dharma talk had been about the idea of, you know, if you wake up in the middle of the night, it might be a good idea just to get up and go practice. I went, oh, I should try this out sometime, I thought, bravely. So it's about 1:30 in the morning, I wake up, I'm wide awake, and I go, I think I'll go practice. So I go into the Dharma hall, and I sit in my usual spot, and the Dharma hall is empty. There is no one there but me. I'm feeling pretty cool. I got the Dharma hall. Usually there's 80 or 90 people there. I'm the only person there. I'm meditating. I'm real cool. I'm following the instructions, right? And I'm sitting there and just there noting my breath and, you know, doing the practice. And I hear this sort of weird sound.
what's that?
You know, and then but now I'm just going to sit here. And 10 seconds later, I hear it again. And again, and it's like, it's starting to really like make me kind of crazy. Like, what the heck is that sound? And then I think, oh my God, someone's fallen into the pool outside and drowned. And they're blocking the outtake valve. And that's what's making the sucking noise. You know, so out of this little noise, this whole incredible story arose. And of course, at the same time I'm telling myself the story, I'm saying, oh, you know, this isn't true. You're just making this up. You know, you're just distracting yourself. But it was just, I actually got up, went outside, and looked in the pool. I couldn't let my mind go still. Out of that one little thing, which simply was just, could be noted, sucking sound, and off onto the next thing arising, I built this entire incredible story that became true. I had to go look to make sure that I wasn't just making this up. Then I looked and I went back to bed, actually. But it was an interesting experience. And then when I thought about it later, I said, wow, out of that one tiny little noise, this whole enormous thing happened. That's the opposite of mindfulness and the opposite of simplicity. It's just, but it's a good lesson to remember when I do that again next time. So that's what mindfulness is and how we can recognize it's actually arisen. And when it's there, what the Buddha is literally saying is when it's there, you note, mindfulness feels like this. And when it's not there, mindfulness, it's not like this. Or no mindfulness present. So it's actually something you note, as with all the other awakening factors. This is really important because when you note that it's arisen, it's very encouraging. It's like we often, you know, in our practice, end up thinking about all the wrong things we do, all the ways we don't do things correctly, all the things we're not doing, as like they said in the book or like the teacher said today. We're always getting caught up in beating ourselves up, essentially. And we're told, I mean, we talk about the five places, we're actually told to note these things when they arise. And it becomes kind of obsessive. The seven factors of awakening are a very great way to overcome that obsession by noting all these positive things when they arise. It's really, it gives you, encourages you, and it also helps you see, that worked. It might be as simple as that. That worked. Now that something actually is progressing here. Something's working. The second of the seven factors of awakening is called Dhamma Vichaya, which means literally investigation, sometimes an investigation of Dhamma, of teaching. And this doesn't mean sitting in your chair thinking about the Dhamma. In the mental Western sense of thinking, it's more being open to intuitive thoughts that arise that help us see the teachings making sense. You know, we start to see as we just sit and watch a thought arise and it's there for a while and it's gone. Another thought arises, it's there for a while, it's gone. This little thing in the back of your mind starts to go, oh, isn't that interesting? Impermanence. Look how impermanent these thoughts are. That's Dhamma Vichaya. That's like investigating, not just sitting there paying attention to what's arising, which you have to do, but also being sort of at a second level, being aware of what this is investigating, what this is illustrating, in a sense, from the teachings of the Dhamma. Once again, we have to study to know what we're looking for. You know, basically we're looking for impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and no self, the three fetters. an investigation, Dhamma Vachaya, is the way we start to actually see those things, not as mental concepts, but as what we are actually experiencing in the moment. We start to experience impermanence. We start to experience the unsatisfactoriness of the world. We start to experience the idea of no self being more than just an idea. Dhamma Vachaya is what helps us make that connection to that's sort of the root teaching. So once there's mindfulness, then we can start to actually see these teachings not as ideas, but as something we're actually experiencing on a moment-to-moment basis. These seven factors are stepwise. Yeah. You have to have mindfulness before Dhamma Vachaya can arise. But if you're mindful of what's arising, then Dhamma Vachaya can arise, and you can start to actually see and understand the teachings in a different way than on the way of mental understanding. It becomes experiential. Then comes virya, energy, effort, courage, strength. These are all different translations. It's one of those words that has multiple translations. Virya comes from the same root as virile. These are both Indo-European languages. Has that sort of connotation, that sort of strong, energetic. And the key point here is, practice takes energy. This isn't magic stuff. We can't just sort of sit there and hope something happens. We have to put energy into the practice. It's a conscious choice. And from it arises out of mindfulness and Dhamma Vachaya, then you go, wow, let's put a little more energy. Let's bear down just a little bit more here and see if I can see a little deeper into impermanence on this sit. My teacher once told me, he said, it's very useful sometimes to make little resolutions at the start of a sit, especially if you're sort of in a space or in a mood where, like, oh, I feel really sort of settled. And, make a little resolution. May I have a deep, intuitive understanding of impermanence in this sitting? Might be a perfectly legitimate thing to say to yourself at the beginning of a sitting. And then see what happens. Maybe nothing. Maybe a deep insight to impermanence will arise. Who knows? But it's like, that takes energy, because now I'm like putting in energy into the practice. This is also, by the way, an antidote to sloth and torpor, one of the kleshas, right? So it's the prime antidote to sloth and torpor. So put more energy into the practice, and sloth and torpor will disappear. The trick with the energy and effort is we have to somehow keep it balanced. It's pretty easy, if you're not careful, to sort of go, I'm going to do this. It kills me. And you start gritting your teeth and tensing in your chair. Your back, it feels horrible after half an hour sitting, and you can't understand why. Too much effort. It's that middle path idea of not too much, not too little. There's another interesting meaning of virya, once again from Joseph Goldstein. And this is what he calls spiritual urgency. So the proximate cause for the rising of virya, of energy, the immediate cause for the rising of energy as a factor of enlightenment is a feeling of spiritual urgency. The Buddha talked of attending to these awakening factors as a matter of vital concern and not simply as something to do in our off hours. There are some powerful reflections that remind us of this urgency. We can reflect on the preciousness of our present circumstances. Whether we think of it in the context of many lives or just in this life, we can see and appreciate how rare it is for all the conditions to come together in order for us to hear the Dhamma, and even more, for us to have the interest, motivation, and opportunity to practice. We are incredibly lucky to be here in this room that's dry and warm, relatively speaking, and, you know, has a bathroom right down the hallway that works, and all the stuff that we just take for granted that make it possible for us to practice. Most people in the world don't have that. And so just thinking, wow, am I ever lucky? Have gratitude for the fact of our life that allows us to take a night off once a week and come and sit. Just for some people, that's like impossible. Just that is an impossible thing, let alone go away and retreat. My God, you know, that's like, and I sometimes tell my wife just before I go away for 6 weeks to sit, this is like a real luxury for me, like a huge luxury to be able to just put down my tools, you know, lock them off in the garage and just go sit for 6 weeks. What an incredible gift to be able to do that. And for her to let me do that, which is why I'm telling her that it's okay for her, you know, that I go off and sit for a long time. And it's just something that, it's this idea of spiritual urgency of who knows how long this is going to last? Who knows how long these conditions, these incredible conditions we're now enjoying right now that allow us to be here and practice, who knows how long that's going to last? Tomorrow. Who knows? It could be just like that. Tomorrow it's gone. We never know. And that gives us that urgency to practice, to really pay attention. That's what is the root cause of our rising. That's, you know, one of those four things I talked about. One of the four was what makes these factors rise? It's that sense of spiritual urgency, that sense of gratitude, a profound gratitude that we have this body and this mind in this place, in this culture, in this time, that allows us to practice. It's an enormous gift that we're so lucky to have. Okay. Onwards here. Next comes, a lot of you who were here last week, and David was talking about the wow in practice. Here's the wow. The next factor of awakening. The fourth is pitti. Pitti translates traditionally as rapture. I don't particularly like that translation. It has all those connotations of, you know, being in some sort of holy roller church and speaking in tongues or something. It's a bit too extreme a sound for me. Another translation is joy. But that's not strong enough. It's somewhere between joy and rapture, okay? And part of this is simply that we need to enjoy the practice. We need to actually really enjoy what we're doing. And that joy comes out of the fact that we have mindfulness, that we're curious, we're investigating, we have energy. If all those are there, then joy arises. This factor of pitti, of spiritual joy, arises. And it's like we start looking at, and we start seeing things arise and go, wow. I mean, I actually have said wow to myself sitting at times. It's like, wow, look at that. Just like it says in the book, and just like they talked about in that Dharma talk, and here it is, wow. It's just thrilling on a mental level. It's like, wow. It's unlike the enjoyment you get from what I'll call normal happiness, sukha, the opposite of dukkha. Sukha is translated as sweet, as happy, as joyful, but it's had the happiness and joy that arises out of things in the world. Not that there's anything wrong with that at all. I just had a great dinner with my wife. I made soup and I made fresh bread, and I really enjoyed it. It was wonderful. It gave me great joy just to sit down with my wife and eat this wonderful meal. But that's not what we're talking about. what we're talking about here, what pitti is something that arises strictly on the mental level out of the practice. It has often has physical manifestations. You know, people start to shake, people start to quiver, all kinds of interesting body sensations. At times when I've been in this area, my body's felt incredibly heavy, like solid. You know, the idea of the sitting like a mountain. Boy, I felt like a mountain. It's just like solid, incredible feeling. Other times it's floaty. I've had places where my feet feel like, even though I'm sitting like this, my feet feel like they're about 2 inches off the floor. They're like floating on some cushion of energy. So there's all these sort of physical manifestations of pitti that arise that are generally quite pleasant. But not always. Sometimes they're kind of scary when they come on really strong. This pitti is one of the things that leads to what are called the jhanas, the deep concentration states. It always precedes jhana states, this state. It's sort of, I'm skipping ahead two little things, but I thought I'd mention it here. And like I said, this is sort of the wow factor, the what makes practice really exciting sometimes and enjoyable is when pitti arises. It is also, raising the yellow warning flag, one of the big danger zones in the practice. Because it's so pleasant, so enjoyable. We start to practice not to reach enlightenment, not to awaken, but to have that great feeling again. Let's just go sit and I can do that again. It was so great. And it becomes quite addictive if you're not careful. It's just so good. And it's tempting because of that. So we have to be able to know that, yeah, pitti has arisen. It's pleasant. Notice pleasantness, but not want to keep it or make it happen again. There has to be this sort of subtle balance. But it is a pretty amazing feeling. And I wanted to just read a poem, because poems sometimes express things much better than me. This is from a book called Go In and In by Dana Faulds. And it's called A Life Here at the Edge. When love lights a fire in the heart, don't be so quick to quell the flames. To be fully alive is to welcome the beloved in countless names and guises, not turn away the wild with the tame. Drink your fill of longing. Let love wash through in waves that lift you up and carry both your daring and your fear straight to unknown places. Yes, there's danger in not staying safely cloaked in morality and labels. But there's life here at the edge, and a choice to be made between thoughtful abandon and passionate restraint. The plaintive cry of the heart can be ignored only at the price of a fully realized life. Throw arms wide to possibilities that move and call you to come forth in freedom and in fullness. Trust the seed of grace within to blossom without sin or sorrow, for you are surely big enough to hold the truth as it unfolds. It sort of describes the feeling I'm trying to talk about here. That's a good description of rapture, I think. Then, these all lead, so there's mindfulness, and then there's what are called the three arousing factors, right? Investigation, energy, rapture, all arousing, energizing. They lead to tranquility, basadi, calm. It's interesting. It's like you're all really energized, and then this shift happens into this very calm, still place. It just, and it's at this place where you have the ability to see emotional states arise without getting caught by them. So whatever is arising, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, you know, pleasant fantasy, an unpleasant memory, whatever is arising, there's a calmness, a stillness that is there. And this is pleasant, but in a very different way than piti. It's a different experience because it has this sense of calmness, stillness, evenness. It's also, by the way, the antidote to restlessness and worry. It's the opposite, in a sense, of restlessness and worry. And the stillness of mind is directly related to stillness of body and stillness of breath. That's why there is so much emphasis in this practice about sitting still. It actually makes a difference if you're still for long periods of time. It has an incredible effect on the mind. The body goes still and you sit and you're just still for a long enough period of time and the mind drops into this state. There's a, not necessarily, but without the stillness of body, it's not going to come at all. But with stillness of body, you just drop into a stiller state of mind. If you just can actually sit still. It's a big effort. Way back there, we're back there. But it's effort. It takes a lot of effort to sit still. You think, well, I'm sitting still, it shouldn't take any effort. Well, actually, to really sit still takes a lot of effort. It's difficult. But this calm state of mind arises out of that stillness of body. And what also happens is the breath becomes very, very subtle. So this, if you want to know whether you're in this state, and one of the four things, know whether what is it that helps you understand why how you're there, is by knowing what's happening with your breath. The first time I discovered this, I was actually sitting and just spaced out, noodling along, blah, 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 blah. About something, I have no remember at all what I was blah, blah, blahing about. It was just, but I was, I'd made this resolve that I was going to start sitting really, really still. And I came out of blah, 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 and was like, oh. Like the note was still. And then this little question arose, well, where's my breath? Because I couldn't even feel my breath. If I paid a real close attention, I could feel this little tiny, tiny motion going on. But it was still. The body was still. The breath was still. Even though I'd been in total blah, blah, blah land, when I came back to the mindfulness, momentary mindfulness in the moment, dead calm mind. Just because I decided to keep my body still and really work at it, put lots of energy into it. So it's a two-way street, this one. But the way to create stillness of mind is through stillness of body and stillness of breath. It really works. For me, anyway. Maybe I'm assuming, since I see it in all kinds of instructions, it works for other people too besides me. Following that, what arises is concentration, samadhi. Now, I want to put a little flag here. Samadhi in Sanskrit means something very different than samadhi does in Pali. This is the Pali version of the word samadhi. You know, samadhi in Pali strictly means concentration. A deeply concentrated mind is one that's in samadhi. And I wanted to actually read a little bit here about what concentration really is from Joseph Goldstein's other book, The Experience of Insight. And basically, this is like the root definition of concentration, I think. There are two kinds of concentration. One is developed by focusing on any single object and developing concentration to the point of absorption into it. So this is any form of using some object or some sound to create concentration, you know, like sitting, looking at a candle or a light, looking at a tonka, repeating a mantra. Metta practice is a constant. Metta practice is a practice of repeating four phrases over and over and over again. This is a concentration practice of this first type. It has a single object. Your mind wanders, you go back to the object. That's it. It's really simple in some ways. Okay. This kind of one-pointedness becomes the basis of many psychic powers. It's a little side note there. The other form of concentration, the kind used for the development of insight, is called momentary concentration. It is a mind which is steady and one-pointed on changing objects. It is this kind of concentration which, in conjunction with all the other factors of awakening, leads to freedom. So it's this, here I am back right where I started when I talk about mindfulness. Only now, concentration is mindfulness that is continuous. It's literally, object arises, it's there, it's gone. Another object, there, gone. And we're seeing everything, that one thing after another, without a break in mindfulness. That's concentration. It's like tuned in, really tuned in, to actually noting what's just going on right now. Yeah, I have to be careful. This doesn't mean you see, I use the word everything. This doesn't mean you're going to see and note everything. If you tried to see and note everything that's actually arising at your sense doors, you'd probably go crazy. Because there's hundreds of them going on right now in this room. There's so many things going on that you could be noting. So it means, and so that mindfulness and concentration in this sense is noting the thing that's most prominent right now. So it might be you're sitting there and, you know, hopefully you're listening to me and my voice is that thing you're concentrating on. But then you sort of glance and go, oh, I wonder where he got that brown shirt. Now you're concentrating on my shirt. And as long as you're really noting my shirt, perfectly good practice. Nothing wrong with that. But so the mind moves from one object to another, one sense impression, one mind impression to another, and it notes them. Boom, boom. And it's just the most thing that's most prominent in the mind right now, that's what's being noted. That's concentration. It's mind is totally concentrated, seeing what's arising, and then the thing that's most prominent, that catches our attention more than anything else, that's what we pay attention to. Until something else arises that has a stronger attention-getting factor, and then our mind moves to that. And that, and that, and that. And it never stops. Concentration. I think that's all I wanted to say. Ah! This is, once again, in my study to prepare for this talk, I came across this not once but twice in two different books, and I went, I never thought of it quite that way. You know, I always thought of concentration as this really strong mental thing, you know. Both books, in big, bold letters, say concentration is totally dependent. You know, when we're talking about what allows concentration to arise, concentration is totally dependent on sila, on virtue, on leading a virtuous life. You can't possibly have concentration without virtue. Because if you are leading a life that isn't virtuous, you're always going to have lots of stuff to worry about. Am I going to get caught? Should I give it back? Should I have done that? Is she going to find out? Is he going to find out? Blah, 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 blah. You know, that whenever we just think about the last time you sort of slipped off the straight and narrow just a little bit. It sort of like just blow it off all well. No, it sat there in your mind. You're probably still thinking about it today. You know, Joseph tells this hilarious story about how when he was like in his teens, or early 20s, and he's in India, he's traveling, and he's staying in some place high up in the mountains. And it was like a little place where people slept, a guest house. And everybody got two blankets. And because it was quite cold, he needed two blankets to keep warm. And for some reason, he got three blankets. And he didn't tell anybody. He just said, well, I got three blankets. I guess I'm lucky. You know? And then someone said, I have only one blanket. Does someone have my extra blanket? He didn't say anything. 40 years later, he still tells a story and feels really bad about it. You know, that little moment of lack of sila, of lack of virtue, it's still there. And you think about those things that nag you, that's what it was. We sort of slipped off the path. And those are the things that stop us from concentrating because we get caught in those stories. Leading a virtuous life is the root cause that allows concentration to arise. So here we are at the sixth of the seven factors, and we're back to the basic ground of life. I find it fascinating that that's true, that this things are so interwoven that even at this level of deep way into the awakening factors, there's virtue right there saying this is the proximate cause. This is what allows concentration to arise. So that just fascinated me when I read it. So, okay, fine. Last but not least, last of them is upekkha, equanimity. So equanimity is an evenness of mind. It's calm, it's concentrated, you're interested, you're full of energy, you have a little sort of rapturous moments. All the other factors are there. You're very mindful. And equanimity arises, and it's a state of mind where you're not thrown by whatever arises. Something unfortunate arises, unpleasant arises, doesn't. You don't lose your equanimity. Something pleasant arises, don't lose your equanimity. It's a state of steadiness of mind that isn't distracted, can't be distracted by the arisings in the world. But, and this is very important, it doesn't mean that you're indifferent to those arisings. In fact, your heart is wide open, taking it all in. It's the opposite of indifference. It's the state of mind where there's the stillness, the calmness, this deep concentration, but at the same time, awareness of everything that's arising without being thrown out, not being caught by one of these things and off on some story. The interesting thing about equanimity is there's an actual meditation practice for equanimity, like there are for all the Brahma Viharas. And the phrase you repeat when you practice equanimity as an actual practice is, you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. Tough love. That's what that basically is. I love you, I really care for you, but you're the only person who can make yourself happy. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. This is the hardest lesson of all to learn on the real world level. You know, it's like we somehow think, oh, it's my job to keep so-and-so happy, whether it's my wife or my kids or my parents or the guy I work with who seems to be really down right now or whatever. Somehow or other, we think we're responsible for making everybody else happy. This is one of the greatest causes of suffering in the world, that belief. We have enough trouble trying to keep ourselves happy, let alone anybody else. I mean, let's be honest. And it doesn't mean that we don't love those people and we don't really care for them and we don't like, you know, I bring my wife coffee in bed some mornings because I know she likes that. So it's not like we don't do those things, but we don't have any expectation of creating that person's happiness. All we're doing is making causes and conditions such that perhaps happiness will arise in and of itself. That much we can do. We can help create causes and conditions that makes happiness possible in their lives, just like we can create causes and conditions to make their lives totally miserable. We can do that, but we can't have any expectation of anything actually happening in terms of their happiness. That's their job. This is hard to take in, because especially if you're a parent, it's like, no, I got to do stuff to make my kids happy. It's just so strong in our culture and in our everything. But in the end, we have to let that go. That's the hardest thing for me was when my daughter came home at 17 and said she was going to marry this guy who drove a tank. Scared the heck out of me. But I had to let go and say, okay, and let's go figure how we can. Or luckily, they then broke up about 2 weeks later. But but it was like one of the scary moments, and a great lesson for me in equanimity is like, okay, this is what she wants to do. Her happiness is up to her. I can't make her happy. I can tell her, which I did. I think this is a terrible idea. But if you want to do this, then I'll help you do it. Yeah. Equanimity. In real life, it's tough. In practice, it's this state of just not being thrown. Because the concentration is there, because all the other seven factors are there, equanimity can arise. I have to be a little aware of the time. There are, the interesting thing about equanimity is that it's a heavy hitter in the Buddha's teachings. It's also the fourth of the four Brahma Viharas. It's also the tenth of the ten paramis. Like all his big lists all end up in the same place, equanimity. It's like that's, I read in one book it said, equanimity is the highest state one can achieve without actually being enlightened. Sounds pretty good. I'll go for that. Okay, then I just want to do a little summarization here. And this is, once again, from, this is a book called Satipatthana, which is a PhD thesis on the Satipatthana Sutta by this monk named Anilayo. And he, this is his summary, so I thought I'd read his because it's way better than mine, probably. Practically applied, the whole set of the seven awakening factors can be understood to describe the progress of Satipatthana practice to the level of deep equanimity. On the basis of well-established mindfulness, one investigates the nature of subjective reality. Investigation of Dhamma. One sustained investigation gains momentum, energy arises, with growing insight into objects of contemplation becoming clearer, and the meditator feels inspired to continue with the practice. There's pitti. If at this point the danger of getting carried away by elation and agitation can be avoided, continued contemplation leads to a state of calmness. When the mind stays effortlessly with its meditation object without succumbing to distraction, in other words, concentration arises, with maturing insight, this process culminates in the state of firm equanimity and detachment. One thing leads to another. It's as simple as that. Now, having said that, I want to tell you a total alternative view. If you look at, in some places, and I've seen teachers actually teach this, the seven factors of awakening are actually two sets of three with mindfulness in the middle as the balance. It's like you've got a teeter-totter, and there's the three arousing factors and the three calming factors are on either side, and mindfulness is in the middle supporting the whole thing. Too much energy, too much rapture. Mindfulness goes, oh, getting kind of excited here. Better calm down. More concentration. I think I'll go over here and have some more concentration and calmness. Too calm, too concentrated. Get sort of like heavy and, oh, better put a little more energy into the practice. Mindfulness telling me, sees this, So mindfulness is the balance between the energizing factors and the calming factors. And it keeps them in balance. It's just another way to look at the whole thing. And all seven of them are there simultaneously, as opposed to in some sort of successive process. It's another way this teaching is taught. I prefer the first, but I want to make sure you understood that there's this other whole way to look at it that I think is kind of interesting, and I've heard my teacher teach it exactly that way, my primary teacher. So it's interesting to see both sides of that. Okay. That's all I have to say, but there are only about 4 minutes left, which means I don't know if we even have time for one question, or should we just sit for a couple of minutes? Maybe we'll save questions for some other time. Okay. In which case, then I have time to read one more poem, too. Which is slip this one. This is a poem by Mary Oliver, one of my current faves. And some of you, I'm sure, have heard this poem before. It's called Mindful. And this is her clear description of what I've been trying to say for an hour in about 40 lines. Every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in a haystack of light. It's what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclimation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teaching as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. The line I love the best is to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. What a good instruction. Let's just dedicate the merit of the practice. Remember, the intent here is just that in hearing the Dhamma and sharing the Dhamma, we've all hopefully gained something. And we just give it away. It's not ours. It's not me. It's just what happened just now. And we just literally, consciously give it away to the rest of the world that needs it as much as we do. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for your kind attention. And if you can help putting the chairs away and the rugs